All right. Merry Christmas and welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website for our previous podcasts. We most recently talked about Strangers on a Train. Before that, we talked about Snowden and Citizen Four in the same podcast. And before that, Primer and Upstream Color, and The Night Of before that, and Scarface. And I also wrote a thing about Rob Reiner, which you can read if you are bored and or are a Rob Reiner super fan. The latter of which seems extremely unlikely. Anyway, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, and yeah, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We made it through the theme song unscathed. Relatively unscathed. There was some scathing. What are we talking about?
It's a two-hander, as they say. The podcast is. We're talking about Lethal Weapon, the film, and
not the arcade game, which I'm sure existed at the time,
or the TV show is what I was going for.
Oh yes, of course.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
There you go. You got there. I believed in you.
That scathing really got to me. yes, and the obvious connection here is the biggest one would be Shane Black, but buddy comedy, crime, action.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you could say Joel Silver is an important connecting thread as well.
Yes.
Absolutely. That we will talk about much less than we will talk about Shane Black, but certainly matters.
And I mean, there's a couple of minor things that tie this together, many of which just seem to show up in a lot of things Shane Black does and is interested in. So
yeah, like his movies are all so similar, and but like sorry,
yeah, I just don't think I'd watch two of them as close in a time as I had with these two. And they're pretty remarkably similar, and they're still fun and still worth watching each of them individually, but to see them this close really reminds you.
Yeah, for sure. And it's weird because over the course of this weekend I watched, with the exception of Iron Man 3, which I have seen but just didn't rewatch, I watched every movie Shane Black is a credited screenwriter on. And, many of those movies got butchered, and he would be the first to tell you that. Lethal
over and over again.
Yeah, exactly. Lethal Weapon and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang are kind of the two closest to the Blackian essence, if you will. But even with these movies getting rewritten on the fly and all that stuff, there's still so many just key aspects that remain unchanged, and yet I still loved all of them, even the terrible ones. You know, like it's fantastic. So
okay, well, so what are the kind of quintessential Shane Black parts to a film?
Two people that love to crack wise in a very, and like crack wise in actually a humorous way. Like some of the, I mean, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is the best example of this. Like, there are so many lines in that movie that are just so funny, and sections where what they're talking about, it has nothing really to do with any sort of plot. It's just super entertaining dialogue. I think Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you get like 23 minutes into the movie before the plot actually starts. which is pretty amazing. And when the Robert Downey Jr.'s character Harry is saying to Val Kilmer's character Perry, as he's leaving a party, says like, I've got a five that says this, and then Perry just goes on this riff about how like, I've got a 10 that says this, I've got a 20 that says this, and then it ends with him talking about a futuristic monkey that only says ficus. Like, yeah. It's just so funny, and his choice of words is always so unique. And I don't know, there's a way to do the Shane Black style well, and it has been done well. I am on record as being a fan, a very vocal fan of the film Bad Boys, and also I like Rush Hour a lot when I was 13 or whenever that came out. So it can be done well without Shane Black being involved in any capacity. But it's just done best when it's Shane Black, you know?
Yeah. And I mean that he's kind of left a little bit of a legacy after making Lethal Weapon. I mean, I think Bad Boys largely happens because of Lethal Weapon.
Oh, same unquestionably. With, same with Rush
same
Hour.
Same with Rush Hour, right? Yep. Yeah.
Like, there's so. Just... Because the... I mean, if you just want to look at Bad Boys, the credited screenwriter on Bad Boys is George Gallo, who wrote Midnight Run, which is also a buddy movie of sorts. But it definitely went through the Lethal Weapon filter before it got made. And then also there was just the, in the way that Michael Bay makes movies, I know that there was a lot of improvisation done on set, and especially when you've got Martin Lawrence and Will Smith together. That'll just happen as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just funny people.
Yeah.
I mean, even just between, well, first of all, to kind of talk about the word choice and the, you know, wisecracking, man, Robert Downey Jr. is such a good find for this kind of movie.
It's perfect. Like, he's, and Val Kilmer's amazing in it too, but Robert Downey Jr. just is just absolutely perfect for Shane Black. And,
that's what I mean. Like, it's hard to picture him, Harry, as anybody else. It's hard to think that Shane Black started without Robert Downey Jr. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that is, like, one of the common threads in watching all of these movies is that the ones that go bad are the ones that are poorly cast. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, as far as movies that Shane Black has written, it's the best cast movie, you know? Because I think... Robert Downey Jr. is incredible in it, of course. Like we've said, tailor-made for Shane Black. And Val Kilmer is great. Michelle Monaghan's spectacular in that movie, too. So it's just like all three of the leads are perfect. Whereas you look at The Long Kiss Goodnight and your leads are Gina Davis, Samuel L. Jackson, and Craig Bierko. And only
those are all names you know I'm a fan of.
One of them works, and I'll let you guess who's good at reading Shane Black dialogue. You know, and that is something that really is very obvious when watching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, especially, and also Lethal Weapon, which I think is a very well cast movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I didn't like Donald Glover before this, but I found myself
Danny Glover.
That was for you.
And it begins. There's a Community joke about it. It's cool. We're not racist.
I swear. Yeah, I found myself liking him even more than I was prepared to like him. I think he's really good in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing about the weird thing about Lethal Weapon is that the first Lethal Weapon is the best movie, but they get better at being together on screen, Gibson and Glover. And, like, the first half of Lethal Weapon 2 is so goddamn fun, it's crazy. And it's because they both figured out both, like, how to say that type of dialogue and how to play off each other. And also Richard Donner kind of figured out a better way to direct them. And just in general, it's like a slicker version. And then it kind of gets bogged down in some problematic plot issues. But yeah, they're just so entertaining together. And watching the Lethal Weapon movies, you really... because, I mean, it's been over 10 years since Mel Gibson has been a superstar. But you really see why it happened, you know, like before it ended. You really see why he was a superstar in these movies.
Yeah. And why it ended.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some ambiguity there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's some like playfully racist moments in the Lethal Weapon movies where you're just like, oh, you could see it coming, you know. And bits that are clearly improvised by Mel Gibson. So anyway.
Well, I thought race was largely absent from Lethal Weapon.
The first one, yes. And then you get all 2, 3, and 4 were movies that were rewritten on the fly. Lethal Weapon 4 specifically, they wrapped shooting 33 days before it was released, which is mind-boggling. Yeah. So, like, there's a lot of, like, on-the-flyness to the Lethal Weapon sequels that just doesn't exist in the first one, which is why the first one works better as a movie.
Yeah, and I mean, with the race thing, I think, you know, obviously it's a big part of Rush Hour. It's a big part of Bad Boys, despite the fact that they are of the same race. I mean, it just comes up a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
I understand in the script, it just that character was not specified ethnically, and they just chose who they did, and it worked out. It's really, not there in the dialogue, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Richard Donner, the director, is also a very forward-thinking person as far as, like, his various causes that he likes to promote. Like, even there's this one shot that comes out of nowhere in the movie Assassins that he directed with Sylvester Stallone, where just a bus drives by with, like, NRA, and then like the circle with the cross out on top of it, and it just adds nothing to the movie. It's just there, and you know Richard Donner's like, yeah, let's do this. Fuck the NRA.
Right. Well, I think this is a good, interesting segue into anything of substance in Lethal Weapon. I mean, I think it's clear we both enjoy it, and audiences and critics seem to enjoy it. I mean, there's sequels and sequels, and as we said, kind of made a little subgenre of its own, or at least kind of brought that back around again and repopularized it.
Yeah, and also like a thing to remember about how popular these movies were is that they spawned a spoof series that I think had multiple entries with the Loaded Weapon.
Loaded Weapon?
Yeah. Like the Lethal Weapon movies were unbelievably popular, and I feel like that's certainly something that was lost to me until I really started to think about it and watch the movies and see how expensive they got as they progressed. But don't underestimate how popular Lethal Weapon was at its time.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, they're just culturally very big. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just looking at it from the cultural level, I think Shane Black has his critics, we'll say. Mm-hmm. And I think often the same way that, you know, people now might talk about Michael Bay, some of the way people used to talk about Shane Black. Would you say that's accurate?
To an extent. Like the general idea behind it sort of fits in that, like, the things that he introduced to filmmaking have diluted good action films, despite the fact that he always did it well, which I think also perfectly describes Michael Bay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, from a more negative aspect, it's, you know, dumb action movies with dudes and, you know, explosions and maybe not the best depictions of women.
Concur.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think Shane Black's a smart guy. I mean, I've listened to him talk a lot, and I think that, you know, the stereotype I just laid out doesn't make him sound as bright as I believe that he is. Mm-hmm. What is there of substance in Lethal Weapon? Because I think that I hadn't seen this movie in a very, very long time, and I was surprised by some of the issues they touched on. I don't think they're front and center at all, but there are some things in there, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think the underlying thing with all of Shane Black's movies is just, I mean, it comes up in the Christmas theme in Lethal Weapon. It hits you right off the at the beginning, where you hear this Christmas jingle over the opening shot. And the idea, I think, behind him setting all of his movies at Christmas, or having each movie hit Christmas at some point over its narrative. I think the idea behind that, and the idea behind having LA prominently involved in like 95% of his movies, pretty much everything but The Long Kiss Goodnight, is that all of these movies are about a darkness that lurks underneath something that seems idyllic and beautiful and wonderful. And his general worldview is that there is nothing really great in the world, and you just kind of have to pick up the scraps of the darkness. And that's something that's very prevalent in pretty much all of his movies. Lethal Weapon's a really good example of it. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, even more so. And that's the substance I always get from any Shane Black movie, and Lethal Weapon for sure, is just that the world is garbage, you know,
it's garbage with a thin veneer of glitz and glamour.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just like, never buy the glitz and glamour, because there's always something happening underneath it, you know, that you kind of don't want to find out about, but you also kind of know exists.
Yeah. The through line is interesting in Shane Black stuff. It's like Christmas, electrocuting people for torture, and mm-hmm. like topless women falling on cars.
Yeah.
It's a really odd combination of things that seem to pop up frequently.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would disagree. Although I think, you know, a topless woman falls on a car in Lethal Weapon, but she gets the car. She's in the car in The Nice Guys when she crashes. She doesn't fall onto the car. They fall together. Where else does a woman? It doesn't matter. Anyway, topless. That's also an 80s movie staple, where if you're making an R-rated action movie in the 80s, you had to have boobs at one point and buns at another point, which Lethal Weapon also has.
Yeah, boobs up front was a pretty common one too.
Yeah, boobs up front, and then you get and also in Lethal Weapon you get the buns pretty quickly too. They just get it over with.
Oh yeah, yeah. Gibson's.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, apparently in the '80s, dude buns were like the hottest thing in the world. It seems like according to action movies that I've seen. The '80s were a time of cocaine and buns. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, I think the one part I definitely forgot of Lethal Weapon is that discussion of '80s, like specifically '80s masculinity, yeah, right up at the beginning.
Yeah, it's great.
What do you like about that?
Well, I like the way that masculinity is portrayed in Shane Black movies in general, and I mean that is a direct. Hitting on, you know, like you take these movies that, you know, it's a cop movie, it's sort of this old-fashioned, like, let's think about Dirty Harry as the movie cop, or if you want to picture Charlie Bronson in Death Wish, either one, but Dirty Harry is obviously more prevalent as time has passed.
I've heard Shane Black talk about that one specifically with okay. ties to Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's this, like, just he just walks in a straight line and shoots people, and there is no deviation from that line. You know, it's just Clint Eastwood. He thinks how he thinks, and sometimes it's questionable, but you know, it ends with him shooting somebody. And that's sort of that 80s comment is a comment on the fact that masculinity is evolving, and masculinity has continued to evolve in the almost 30 years since Lethal Weapon came out. And I think you can get this real. There's always like a really interesting conversation between old school masculinity and modern masculinity that exists within Shane Black movies. I think like you've got Lethal Weapon coming in the second half of the '80s. I believe it was released in 1987, right? So when you look at the masculine action hero at that point, you know, we're in a post Schwarzenegger and definitely post Stallone world, right? And where you can kind of break these things down pretty easily in the, Rambo 1 versus Rambo 2, you know, where Rambo 1, there's a scene of Rambo crying at the end and talking about how Vietnam scarred him. Rambo 2, he doesn't really care about PTSD anymore. He's just murdering people. And what Shane and what the imitators latched onto was Rambo 2. Like all the, and in the first stuff, all the cool shit in the forest where he's running around hunting people. And so people imitated Rambo. But they left out the crying scene, basically, right? So you get all of these like hyper masculine characters, and what Lethal Weapon does is show you that character, and with Riggs, Mel Gibson's character, and when we meet him, we see him in this sort of like sad setup, right? He lives in a trailer. He
drinks 30 seconds after he wakes
exactly.
up. He drinks poorly, by the
way. I know. He's
got, I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, to quote Airplane, he's got a drinking problem. And yeah, and then, you know, and then we get our introduction to Murtaugh as well. Actually, I think we're introduced to Murtaugh first, but anyway, it doesn't matter. We flip between the two stories before they meet. And then we get Riggs doing his first loose cannon moment, shall we say, where he does that drug bust. And then immediately after the drug bust, we see him crying and almost committing suicide. And that scene of him crying and almost committing suicide is what sort of sets Lethal Weapon apart, right? Because it shows us this masculine loose cannon, not unlike Rambo in the sequels or a variety of Arnold Schwarzenegger characters or Van Damme characters, but then also gives him some humanity. And what Lethal Weapon does so well is it jumps in between, like weaves in between those things frequently and often very quickly. And that is sort of what made it stand apart from the pack. And it's not like it invented the action comedy or the buddy cop genre. Like even in the 80s, you've got 48 Hours with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy. You've got Eddie Murphy and Beverly Hills Cop. And like I mentioned, you've got Midnight Run. Those are all... like either action-ish comedies in Beverly Hills Cop's case or a buddy comedy. And what Lethal Weapon does, even apart from those, is show just a broader range of emotions. It's the discussion of masculinity that exists. It's the 80s now. You can cry in front of a woman or whatever, you know? And I think that's the thing that is cool about Lethal Weapon is that it does a lot of things that have already been done, but the way it weaves those things together is just different.
And then where does that fit in with Die Hard?
Well, it's a lot of the same things. And It is interesting. Well, yeah, exactly. And we see Riggs in pain later on in Lethal Weapon when he's getting tortured. And a key moment of Die Hard is that we see John McClane in pain as well. And
his feet get up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that they came out a year apart from each other and are both produced by Joel Silver. Like, I would imagine there was some sort of Shane Black influence exists on Die Hard that is exists in like a last rewrite sort of phase. But just because of how I know Joel Silver feels about Shane Black and the fact that Shane Black and Joel Silver would have been around each other a lot at this time. So I feel like there is some influence about it that we don't know about, but there is also an element of concurrent thought that I think exists too. You know?
Yeah.
Cause I don't really... like this type of character would have still existed had Shane Black not come around, but I also can't name the screenwriter of Die Hard off the top of my head. You know? So there's some element of Shane Black that is unique.
Yeah, and I think you're right by saying it's...
Oh, Steven D'Souza. Anyway.
A lot of it could just be, you know, behind the scenes. And, you know, there are these kind of straight lines. You know, one thing comes out and then that has its effect on everything else. But, yeah, I think it's just these people working on these things and having all these things in their mind at once and just the general cultural shift of the invincible 80s action hero kind of going by the wayside and never ever going to disappear completely, but just culturally that kind of seeming a bit old by that point.
Yeah, for sure. And you can also, it just ties in well to the 80s of the Reagan 80s and the booming economy of like, we're just the best, you know, like that's sort of the thing that that type of action hero really ties into, and you sort of start to get people starting to worry about the lasting effects of that sort of mindset, you know. And then you also get Wall Street probably in 1987, which is very much about the problems of the 1980s, you know.
Yeah, the same thing but in a different industry, sort of, or a different line of work, I guess.
Exactly, still the great American individual, you know.
Yeah, and this wouldn't be the first film to cast the Vietnam conflict in a negative light by any means, but you know, that's there too. Our two main characters seem to be suffering negative effects from it, one seemingly more so than the other.
Yeah.
But the villain in this is basically the result of Vietnam, right?
Yeah, it's exactly.
These people who are trained to do all these things, and now the war is over, and they've got these materials and expertise, and, you know, it's even so much of still having a connection in Asia. You know, it's not just we used to be soldiers and now we're looking for something to do. There's such a straight line from what we did during this war and how we're building a criminal enterprise out of it now.
Exactly. It's just like all the four main male leads in this movie. It's like a sliding scale of Vietnamness and who is able to cope with PTSD the best, you know?
Yeah.
So
whether it's through Three Stooges drug deals or
oh man, they really amp up the Three Stooges stuff in the sequels. When they get their third stooge with Joe Pesci, it really turns things up a notch. It's pretty great.
Yeah, the interview that I did read about from Shane Black about Lethal Weapon, he was saying he wanted to make an urban western inspired by Dirty Harry, about a violent character, as he says, quote, reviled for what he did, what he is capable of, and the things he believed in. So, I mean, that's Riggs. Mm-hmm. You know, and that kind of seems like more that 80s character we were talking about, someone, you know, this is kind of, you know, Dirty Harry to a T, someone who's willing to do all the things that might be illegal, but are for the greater good, or at least that's the way that his mind works. Mm-hmm. And so where do you find Lethal Weapon and maybe all of Shane Black's career lands on that kind of character, though?
In just sort of having somebody that is kind of having people that are kind of like mavericks a little bit, like willing to sort of navigate the system as they see fit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's certainly some questionable navigation going on in Lethal Weapon specifically, mostly in the Gary Busey fight at the end where they're surrounded by cops.
Oh boy.
Like, for a movie that makes so many good decisions and then has that idiotic scene at the end, it's so weird.
Well, there's a few things there. One, it seems that nothing is at stake in this fight, right?
Yeah, because yeah, exactly.
No matter what happens, he's going to get arrested and tried for whatever crimes he committed up until here. Mm. I mean, I guess if anything, it is kind of that masculinity issue of what we're talking about, that there's still something to be proved by just who can kick the shit out of someone better. That still means something in this version of masculinity.
I hear there's a deleted scene where they take out their dicks and measure them.
Well, my understanding of that real editing process of that fight is that it's way longer than it is in the movie. And they cut it down, which, you know, proves what we were talking about. It's so weird. Just if another cop somehow died by being shot while they're standing around watching this fight on the front yard, it's so silly.
Yeah, I mean, it's bonkers. But as for the maverickality of it all, they certainly make some decisions that I would deem questionable throughout this movie. Riggs seems to murder a lot of people that didn't have to be murdered. And Murtaugh probably does too, and it's just sort of slipping my mind. He just sort of pales in comparison to Riggs. I don't know. It's just, these things don't really register to me because I was one when a Shane Black world started to exist, right? Like, I grew up in a post Shane Black existence where, and specifically, like, as a youth, really liked a lot of these buddy cop movies. So, seeing, you know, these cops that agitate their Captain Sciatica or whatever, like, it's just, it's par for the course. So it doesn't really stop me at all. You know, I just sort of assume it's going to happen. You know?
Right.
So what, do you have any specific examples?
No, it's just, I don't know where the arc really goes for Riggs. I mean, he seems happier by the end. He says he's not crazy. He's willing to kind of go in the domestic zone again by eating dinner with, you know, his partner's family after his wife has died, and he kind of seems to give up that existence. But I don't know if there's a significant change in his character otherwise. I mean, I don't know if he kind of exercised all those demons in that one final lawn fight or what.
The classic lawn fight of putting your issues to bed.
80s therapy was different, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You just had to beat the shit out of Gary Busey with a stick, and then you got over all your traumas.
Well, he wields, what, a basketball pole?
I don't know, man. I will say there are some shots in that sequence where, and I don't think Lethal Weapon as a movie is spectacularly directed. I think at times its budget really shows itself, but I think there are some high points. And one of the things about that scene specifically that I really enjoyed is that, you know, it's raining in that scene and they weren't afraid to let the lens get really wet. And it created some interesting looking shots that didn't come to mind in my head as anything I'd seen before. And I thought that was interesting. But it's kind of like the arc of the movie is basically getting us to the point where Riggs admits that he's not crazy and that he does want to be invited into a house. Like he wants some sort of domestic life. And that's another thing, another sort of shade of the 80s Superman, if you will, or the Great American Individual, is that beneath this sort of potentially psychotic exterior is somebody that wants to be loved and somebody that wants to be a part of the things that Murtaugh has. And for Murtaugh, it's sort of like he gets a close friend that he didn't have before. You know, you can see in their house that it's still under construction. And this is even before a car goes through it. It's their kitchen is still being renovated. Like, this is not a house that is complete. It is something that is still, a family that is still open to inviting a new element, be it a completed kitchen or Mel Gibson. And that's, I think that is the core of the movie that we're supposed to get to, is that, one, Riggs does want something like what Murtaugh has, and two, Murtaugh's life isn't complete and that he kind of does need somebody like Riggs in his life to really, really make his life as good as it can be, despite the fact that at the beginning of the movie, Murtaugh has pretty great life, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't want people breaking into my bathtubs, but
he has a lot of, like, it, I don't know if it was the 80s, but baths are weird. I feel like as a society, we've moved past them. He has another bath in the third movie, which is again, just sort of to tie into the first, but I just, yeah.
Anyway. Briggs kind of sneaks into his bedroom at one point. It's a pretty open doors policy at the Murtaugh household, seemingly. Yeah.
I think that kind of makes sense, though, because they've got four kids plus his wife. Like, I can totally understand how you kind of become numb to people sneaking around your house, walking around your house, just because, like, you have to, or else you would never get any sleep, you know?
Sure.
Especially since, like, he's a cop. He's got to be so damn tired all the time, you know?
Yeah. So. Do you want to make sure we get some more Kiss Kiss Bang Bang content in here?
Oh, of course. We've got to talk about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. We haven't gotten to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew I loved Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I hadn't seen it in probably 8 years and watched it again. Turns out I really love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang a lot. I think that this movie's so, so good and so funny. And I remember years and years ago when we were in university, me trying to convince you to watch it and describing it as like a crime movie meets Arrested Development, which I still think is a comparison that holds water. And it's just so, it's so enjoyable. It's such an enjoyable film. Like, I couldn't believe how much fun I was having, despite the fact that I'd already seen the movie probably 5 to 10 times. You know?
Right. And other than it being funny, what is the appeal for you?
Again, it's just sort of like, I know I'm harping on this, and I said this a lot on the Nice Guys podcast. It's just that Shane Black kind of speaks my language, and that he makes these genre movies, these movies in genres that I like, and sort of adds a little twist on them, but also keeps this pervasive thread of one, playing with expectations. That's a huge thing that Shane Black does that I love. He is sort of like this, it's weird, he's like a contrarian that is also okay with tropes, like, because all of his movies are built on tropes, but what he does within them is sort of contrarian. Like, I think the best example is the idiot line, which is one of my favorite lines in the history of cinema, when Perry says to Harry, I'm gonna Google it, but
look up idiot in the dictionary and you know what you'll find.
Yeah, exactly. What, a picture of me? And he says, no, the definition of idiot, which you fucking are, which is hilarious. And I can speak from experience, when you give them that lead in, they always say what the definition of idiot when you're actually using this line in real life. It's actually a line in movies that you can, like, joke from a movie that you can set yourself up for, and it works 99% of the time. And that's the type of thing, like, he's really good at, is showing you this thing that where you expect one thing to happen and then something totally different happens, you know? And he's a contrarian, which I can support, and also just that underlying feeling of, this is, the world is full of sadness, and if you just look like a bit under that glossy layer, as you put it, you will find something horrible, but it doesn't mean you can't still laugh at life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something that is very much throughout Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know?
Yeah, and again, like the Nice Guys, LA is so much of a big part of that, right?
Exactly, and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang adds in small town Indiana, Embry, Indiana specifically, which I don't know if it's a real city or not, but you know, it's a small town in the Midwest. Apologize to all the people in the Midwest for saying fuck so much. It's like one of the last lines in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, and that's sort of the feel that exists in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know?
Yeah, and just, I mean, it starts off with the self-referential meta humor right away.
Yeah, and that's something that I think that has been, because, like, I mean, obviously the big difference between Lethal Weapon and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, as far as on an impact level, is that Lethal Weapon had an impact, you know, and, and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang didn't. I think partially because Warner Brothers just didn't market it, because I remember when it came out, I saw a poster and was like, oh, that looks kind of interesting. And then it played at one theater in my city for like three showings, none of which I could make it to, so I didn't see it in theaters. But yeah, it's bizarre that it seemed like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang never had a chance, but like, I can totally understand why it wouldn't make money, and Lethal Weapon is just sort of this more bombastic movie. But, yeah, they are both produced by Joel Silver, both have a budget of $15 million, if I remember correctly, but one is $15 million in 2006, and the other is $15 million in 1987. So yeah, it's kind of a bummer that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang wasn't a bigger hit, but I think it has sort of, I don't know, it feels like something that has had a small, quiet effect on people, whether or not a certain type of person, whether or not they understand it. Like that, as you're talking about, the way the narration works. When I was writing that Rob Reiner thing that I wrote, and obviously I'm not comparing myself to Shane Black, except for the fact that I'm currently comparing myself to Shane Black, but like, when I was writing that Rob Reiner thing, I was like, this is bad. How can I make this not terrible? And then I just went through it and added in shit where I made fun of myself and how predictable the thing was. And that's 100% the Shane Black thing that I think has just stuck with me over the 10 years since I saw this movie for the first time. It's just something that's so entertaining and just memorable that whether or not you're actually thinking of it when you do use it, like commenting on these things, is it's an influence that exists whether or not you realize it, or, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things where maybe not a ton of people saw it, but the right people saw it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good example. And it's even got that cachet that it made most of its money outside America. And, you know, America is the place for stupid movies, mm-hmm. and the rest of the world is the place for smart movies. Mm-hmm. So for it to kind of be made within the Hollywood, like in Hollywood, about Hollywood, about LA, but not necessarily do well with the crowds you would expect, from that description. But, you know, the right people seeing it and people in the smart country seeing it, as bad as that sounds.
Yeah, it's like the Velvet Underground thing where like only 100,000 right. people saw the Velvet Underground or heard the Velvet Underground and Nico record, but they all started bands, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, it's for people. I mean, and so much of it is about film itself and about writing, that I'm sure it's just influential to an important group of people, I'll say.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and Shane Black had this sort of this following in the 90s that kind of existed, despite the fact that most of his movies aren't, or most of the movies that he's credited as a writer on aren't good. It's still odd to me. I still haven't been able to figure it out. I think it was just sort of this, Quentin Tarantino became sort of the dominant version of this, where it's like, it's just this kid that likes movies a lot that is now getting paid millions of dollars for a screenplay. And so he was sort of the poster boy for that until Pulp Fiction came and stole his thunder. I've always been fascinated by that, how that existed before Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I do think is will go down as probably his best work. Like, I can't imagine him topping it, just because I think he kind of has to work in sort of higher budgets to get his movies made. And it's just a better movie than The Nice Guys. So, but, this is a Shane Black quote. He said, it's the first time in my career where what I wrote on the page is on the screen. And it does really feel like what I was saying earlier, where, there are so many things in the process of getting a movie made that gum up a script. And, when your movie's script is so precise, like what we've been talking about, there's so much precision involved in the words of these movies.
Arrested Development episode.
Yeah, exactly. And, when Rennie Harlan starts getting his hands in the mix, you know, it messes things up. And same with Bruce Willis, and Tony Scott had a horrible experience making The Last Boy Scout by the sounds of things. And it just is, it's the first time where Shane Black was kind of in control. And, Joel Silver produced that movie as a favor. Because Shane Black made him so much goddamn money in the 90s, he basically went to Warner Brothers and found a way to get $15 million for Shane Black for this movie. And Warner Brothers was like, okay, go make your movie and show us when it's locked. Which is to say, when it is 100% done. And then, so it's just like, they trust Joel Silver. And then Joel Silver, after the first little bit, apparently got even more hands off than he already was. And just let Shane Black make his movie. And that's sort of how you get something like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where Shane Black finally gets to make a Shane Black movie, you know?
Yeah, and even addresses it within that movie, talking about how the studios don't want a movie with a downer ending. Mm-hmm. And that's his, from what I understand, one of his main problems with the movies that he is a screenwriter on that didn't turn out nearly the way that he wanted them to.
Yeah, specifically Lethal Weapon 2, which he has been quoted as saying is like his original version of Lethal Weapon 2, which has apparently been lost to history, is his favorite script that he's ever written, and Riggs dies at the end of that movie. So yeah, he does kind of always want to kill somebody. I really enjoyed that bit. I had actually forgotten that the way that Perry comes back, I knew he came back and that there was a comment on it, but bringing Abe Lincoln into the mix is a nice added level, you know?
Oh, that's a lot. Yeah. Hey, well, when your ringtone's I Will Survive, you're obviously going to make it to the end of the movie.
Yeah, that is a good point. Yeah.
Did you remember all the Lord of the Rings jokes?
I did. The Lord of the Rings joke and the Hunt for Red October one. That's what I really like as far as the commenting on itself. Like, that was a terrible scene. Oh, is that going to come into play later? Like, That I think is one of the highlights of this movie to me. It's just because that's a comment on basically every action movie we've ever seen, where there's even some element of intrigue. There's always a scene that doesn't seem to add anything to the movie, and you're just immediately like, well, all right, I guess this is going to come into play later, you know?
Chekhov's whatever.
Yeah, Chekhov's Corbin Burnson. that classic trope. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel... It's so odd, because when I talk about Shane Black movies, I just feel like I'm simultaneously not doing them justice and also holding them up to too high of a level. And I just sort of, I feel like it is just, whereas with most movies that I love specifically as much as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I can point to specific reasons that are like very wordy that I can explain over a long period of time. excuse me, and explain why I love this movie and why it has an effect on me. And like with Shane Black's movies, it is such a small thing, and it's so, well, it's a big thing, but you just can't really put it into words. It's just sort of this feeling and this worldview that exists in these movies that I think just really, it just speaks to me and kind of is like, it's a different version of a thing that so many people have done, but it's the best version of that thing, you know? And I love it very much.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you're wrong, too.
I know. I feel like I should be able to put it into words. And I felt this way after I saw The Nice Guys, or after we did our podcast on The Nice Guys, too, that it's just like, he's a guy that's so good with words, but I can't find the way to put the words together that describe why he's awesome, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
I feel badly about that. So. So, yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.